Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum, and today we're going to discuss the MQ-9 Reaper, one of the most iconic combat aircraft in modern history. Whether you call it a remotely piloted aircraft, an unmanned aerial vehicle, or a drone, this aircraft, its mission enterprise, and the people who operate it have fundamentally transformed what it means to fly and fight. And not all of the chapters have been written for this aircraft. While the MQ-9 may be best known for what it's done over places like Afghanistan and Iraq in low-intensity counterinsurgency and counterterrorism operations, future years will see it rack up new accomplishments in far different operating situations around the globe. Now, to help me explain our thesis for today's show, I'd like to bring on Mitchell Institute's Executive Director, Doug Berkey. Doug, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, I appreciate being here.
So, Doug, bottom line, what makes the MQ-9 such a revolutionary aircraft?
Yeah, if you look at this aircraft and kind of the class it represents, and I would batch the MQ-1 Predator in with this, which preceded it, but they're cousins. It really represents the first time that we married up the sensor with the actual ability to shoot all on one platform, and then wired that back to operators that really represent a command and control construct. And it really gives the operator the ability to see something, assess what they want to do. And if that answer is taking the shot, they do it immediately. Or if they want to gather pattern and life information to really hone in on securing the desired effect the most prudent way possible, they can wait for that moment. But before, we were always trying to jockey around with getting the ISR aircraft, which was kind of a dedicated aircraft, overhead of something. You develop the pictures or the imagery off board, and then you'd have to marry that up to an aircraft that would go drop the bomb or whatever. And that was really complex, and there was a lot of time in between. The ability to just see something and do something all in one package was incredible, and it absolutely blew people's minds. And it's important to emphasize that because we take it for granted now. It's just, of course, we can do this. But rewind the tape 20 years ago, this was revolutionary.
Well, and I'm glad you bring up, rewinding the tape 20 years ago, because we know the MQ-9 has been a staple of air operations in the Middle East, and of course, Central Asia over the past two decades. But, and our defense leaders are pushing hard to dial up the capability much more stressful scenarios like the Pacific against China or in Europe against Russia. And they're right. It's the threat that's driving our planning and preparation. But in America, obviously can't ignore that. But is the MQ-9 still going to be relevant? It's pretty obvious that it's not a stealthy supersonic plane that we generally think of for those types of scenarios.
No, I hear you, but I also got to push back. I get frustrated with people that try to make this an either or choice. It's the wrong answer. And really where we need to go is it's both, because the battle space isn't all one thing or another. It's a layers of different degrees of threats and the kind of capabilities that are useful and all of that. And so bottom line, the whole sensor shooter complex that I talked about, the long dwell time that an MQ-9 can orbit on station, the ability to have these crews linked up and flow people in that have different expertise. I mean, they're all incredibly highly trained. That is useful for a lot of different things. And so, yeah, we're probably not going to see MQ-9s over downtown Beijing, but there are still numerous areas in the battle space where we can employ these. And so when I'm looking at missions like airbase defense, looking at sea patrol for kind of a maritime sensor shooter construct in certain regions, electronic warfare, wide area surveillance, communication relays, all of that. The ability to loiter and have that sensor shooter complex is really powerful. And there are so many areas where I can employ this. And most importantly, it allows me to flow forward the high-end assets that are really finite in their supply, whether it's B-2, F-22, F-35, or B-21, allow them to go forward by taking care of these missions a little bit lower down the line in a highly competent way. And we need to think about stacking our force that way to get the most out of it. It's not all one thing or all the other. It's really kind of a interdependent tapestry of strengths, and you stack them appropriately.
Sure. Well, I am going to ask you this a little bit of a different way, because what we're discussing here makes it seem like it's obviously not a choice. So you've hit the notion pretty hard, and we really talk about this a lot at Mitchell, that the Air Force is the oldest and smallest it's ever been. So would it even be a real option to bench this sort of capability with the MQ-9?
No, and you're really hitting the nail on the head there. To answer your question, the Air Force actually has tried this, and the Hill didn't approve, and frankly, Mitchell Institute agreed with that assessment from the Hill. And it's simply because the Air Force is so small, so old, and so fragile that you've got a bunch of highly capable aircraft that are relatively young. They're bought and paid for. And like I said, I can see numerous areas where we employ these that why wouldn't you keep them on board? We really don't have a fallback. And the ones that people are pointing to, hey, I need to retire these to free up cash, those are PowerPoint solutions in many regards. They're very theoretical. They're out in the horizon. We still need capabilities that can deliver today. And it's, you know, the China scenario, Russia, all of that. Of course, we need to prepare there. But ISIS should also really scare us. It kind of proves the point here that the U.S. might want to take a certain policy vector, but we don't control all the cards. The adversary has a vote. And so to say that we're going to immediately roll out of the Middle East or Africa or other areas is unrealistic. And so we need to keep a broad range of capabilities and capacity to handle different missions effectively and efficiently. You know, something like the MQ-9, it can play across the board. It obviously plays entirely across the board in something like the Middle East or Africa. It's more of a tiered strategy in a place like Pacific or Europe, but it's valuable no matter where. It's important to note here as part of this conversation that the MQ-9 the Air Force is flying isn't the current technical baseline. There are more sophisticated options out there. What we're seeing the Air Force fly is what they've chosen to budget to. So it's actually an older set of capabilities. Ironically, countries like the UK are flying a more advanced model. It's going to come online soon called the MQ-9B that solves a lot of the challenges that some of the Air Force operators have cited. It's just a matter of money, and I get it. The service has to make choices. I'd still say what they have today is very capable, and it's kind of like, look, if you decline buying the backup camera on your Ford F-150 that you just bought, that's not Ford's problem. It's what you chose. So, you know, if they want to dial these things up a little bit more, they could do that. But what they got now is still insanely capable.
Now, Doug, I really appreciate your analysis, and most Americans would not suspect that the F-16 I flew in combat had the computer technology of what was closer to a Commodore 64 than what's in the Apple iPhone. So to quote a good friend of mine who's in the aviation business, all of these programs move at the speed of money. And your idea of expanding our operating environment makes a lot of sense, too. Now, everything has gotten pigeonholed over the last 20 years and operating in an incredibly narrow lane of mission execution. So what I mean is combat that was incredibly permissive compared to a full-scale war. It was at slow speeds and had some threats, but not really limiting in any way to our forces. And it was also at an incredibly low tolerance of risk. So here's the good news. Airmen and Guardians get it. A majority of the force joined after 9/11, when the majority of military focus was turned overnight into low-intensity nation-building and counterinsurgency operations. So think about this. Those who enlisted in the Air Force in 2001 are eligible to retire this year. So in many ways, the bulk of this population and the bulk of the general officers who lead them are facing a back-to-the-future moment, having to relearn lessons their predecessors learned in the Cold War. But they also do this amidst the realities of an information age. Up next, I'd like to welcome back Lieutenant Colonel Johnny Duray. As you remember, he's an incredibly experienced MQ-9 pilot, and we spoke to him back in episode 13 about the weather's role in military operations. Today, we're going to pick his brain about flying and fighting with the Reaper. Johnny, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Slick. It's really an honor to be invited back a second time here.
All right, Johnny, to kick this discussion off, talk to us about the strengths of the MQ-9 coming out of two decades of nonstop RPA operations. It's crazy to say that, but what are the capabilities that the platform provides that are in the most demand by the COCOMs?
Yeah, that's a great question. And Doug alluded to this earlier, to many of the capabilities. And essentially, the capabilities that have made the aircraft revolutionary are the same attributes the COCOMs are after. So, you know, first and foremost, it's that unblinking intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. I mean, an MQ-9 platform is going to be up in the air providing 16, 17, 18, 19 hours of uninterrupted intelligence gathering from a single aircraft that requires no extensive aerial support network. So in other words, to get that, you're not going to have refuelers that are needed and the associated costs, logistical challenges, and risk associated with that extensive support network. You're going to get a high definition feed that is truly revolutionary. I mean, we're at the point now where we're starting to be able to, you know, pick out, you know, the color of shoelaces from a pretty high altitude. You're also going to get a very flexible aircraft. You know, the MQ-9 is able to shift to a different location and gather intelligence really on a dime. There's other assets out there, both satellites and strategic level ISR manned aircraft that can provide, you know, high definition and can push the feed, but they can't move on in a moment's notice. They require, you know, extensive planning and therefore they're unable at times to really exploit some of the fleeting intel gathering opportunities that we see downrange. MQ-9 also is extremely modular. You have a lot of plug and play collection capabilities that are always changing on the aircraft. It has an inherent finishing option. So in other words, it's a sensor shooter, like we like to talk about, all in one. So when you do have the intel support that would support a kinetic option, there's no need to wait to generate up another fighter type asset to get on station. The MQ-9 can kind of do it all at one. It's quiet as well. And the last reason I think is the combatant commanders can really accept an increased risk when they're looking to employ the MQ-9 because it is unmanned. And so they can accept risk into certain areas that you otherwise couldn't with manned aircraft. And so I think, you know, for all these reasons and a few others, you've seen just an insatiable demand for RPAs and more specifically MQ-9s in the past two decades.
All right. Now, from a tactical standpoint, and we'll obviously stay in the unclassified realm here, what was the one mission that you were part of that showcased how the MQ-9 was the only platform that could get the job done and why?
Yeah, I have a good one here. And what I'll do is I'll tell the story and then I'll explain afterwards why the MQ-9 was really the only asset that could have done this. So a few years ago, you know, across the pond, a large terrorist camp, about 50 or 75 fighters that were going through training. And I, to put it frankly, or to put it clearly, they were way out in the boondocks is the best way to describe it. And so they were out there with an underground cave system in an area that had very high canyon walls. I would say they were Indiana Jones-like type walls. And we were out there collecting intelligence for a few days, and the powers that be, you know, really wanted to execute the strike with fighters or bombers. And that was understandable. But they, you know, obviously they wanted the deep magazine, and with the number of people at the camp, that's kind of the option they were looking at. We were really a tertiary option as the MQ-9, but eventually, you know, they figured out, hey, that they're just not going to get the support that they want from those other assets. So they said, you know what, let's just go ahead and throw MQ-9s at it. So four MQ-9s overhead, we'll load them up with a couple 500 pounders and as many Hellfires as we can find, and let's kind of see what happened. And, you know, essentially within about a 3-hour window, the MQ-9s conducted a coordinated strike and really decimated the camp. And so the reason why the MQ-9 was really the only asset that could have executed the way it was executed that day, there's four things that stand out. First and foremost, the MQ-9s had an intimate battle space awareness because they'd been staring at the target for days on end. And so, in other words, the pilots that were flying that mission knew every nook and cranny in that entire mountain network. They knew where the terrorists were going in and out of the cave system at. They knew where they were going to gather in large groups and smaller groups. And that kind of intimate battle space awareness, you just can't get from a fighter or a bomber asset that are coming on station and seeing the target for the very first time and looking to execute. Second reason the MQ-9 was ideally suited for this was a lot of the shots required what I call threading the needle. Again, those windows of opportunity to shoot were extremely narrow given the terrain down below. And when you're flying at the altitude and speed that many of our bombers are flying at, they simply have no margin of error if the window even exists for them at all to be able to thread the needle like that. An MQ-9 is flying at you know, a third of the speed of some of these assets, and therefore we can exist in that window for a lot longer. Third, it required extensive reattacks, and everyone kind of knew going in that was going to be the plan. However, again, based on the speed and the altitude and that HD camera, MQ-9s were able to track and prosecute targets down there even an hour after the initial strike. And, you know, with fighter and bomber aircraft, not necessarily able to hang around that long, especially without a refuel. And they simply can't just park overhead and stare down into a canyon the way an MQ-9 can. And then lastly, the big piece that was a success, or part of the success for this strike, was just the interconnectivity piece. Every MQ-9 that was executing the strike could see and talk to the other MQ-9 that was in the formation with them. All the feeds from the other MQ-9s were pumped into the cockpits. And so all of that real-time information sharing was absolutely key, particularly for those re-attacks. And so having that uninterrupted communication and high-definition feeds, it was just absolutely crucial to executing not only the initial simultaneous attack first run, but even more so on the re-attacks that were needed to achieve mission success in that mission.
Just to be clear here, these capabilities and these strengths are really important because, as I understand it, you are still operating in numerous regions that reflect the lower end of the threat spectrum. So from my perspective, looking back, I think ISIS taught us a lot about how the adversary is going to have a vote about where and when we need to engage. So do you foresee these sort of activities continuing?
Yeah, no, I agree, Slick, at least for the foreseeable future. You know, I mean, frankly, there's just not a lot of options right now out there without taking on increased risk to either our force or our people or using our higher end equipment. And so, you know, I think our policymakers have continued to signal a desire to keep pressure on many of the violent extremist organizations out there to prevent another 9/11 attack or another ISIS caliphate from forming. You know, Afghanistan, we'll see what happens here in a few months. But, you know, previously they've indicated a desire to keep a military pressure on the Taliban to drive them to the negotiating table. And frankly, you know, COCOMs are in a tough spot right now. You know, the combat commanders are no longer in a position where they have the ability to throw an army division or even a PRT, a provincial reconstruction team at a problem. They just don't have that. The Air Force has signaled a desire to, you know, bring home fourth and fifth generation fighters and bombers, you know, to help preserve their hours and help give them the chance to pivot to great power competition and readiness. And so I'd imagine the combatant commanders are kind of looking around at this point and saying, well, you know, at least I have all these MQ-9s still with me. And so I think because of what we talked about previously, they're really ideally suited to keep up the pressure campaign at a relatively low cost, you know, through intel collection, signals exploitation, and precision strike. So, you know, in reality, although there's less need right now for the number of kinetic strikes you've probably seen circa 2015 to 17 at the peak of the ISIS fight, we're not seeing a significant drop off on our end in our overseas commitments or taskings.
So Johnny, obviously the return of peer competitors like Russia and China are also going to have us focused on the high-end threat spectrum. And the Reaper is going to need to be part of that because COCOMs will need its capabilities and capacity. So what are your thoughts on the MQ-9 being pulled in two directions at once?
Yeah, that's the question of the moment right now for the MQ-9 community. And it's an incredibly accurate assessment of what we're dealing with right now. But I'll add an additional layer to this problem. And that is right now, as we are being pulled between these two different mission sets, we're simultaneously trying to transform how the enterprise presents forces in our, what we're calling our deploy to dwell concept. And essentially, you know, for the first two decades, we've been on a continuous deployment. And so what that means for the average person coming out of training is they hit an MQ-9 squadron and they just are deployed flying combat for the next 4, 5, 6, 7 years of their life. And, you know, it's unsustainable. And the Air Force recognized that was fairly unsustainable. So less than a year ago, we went to this construct where, you know, we basically split some of the squadrons in half and said, okay, half the squadron is going to fly the combat mission. The other half is going to stay at home. And then, you know, we're going to do that for a certain amount of days. And then we're going to go ahead and swap. And so I bring this up because although that's an additional layer to the problem, it's actually also, in my opinion, part of the answer. And I think that's because a deploy to dwell construct actually starts to free up the space that we need to really think and pivot and move the community toward being effective in the great power competition era. You know, previously, we really didn't have time to think about anything other than the war on terror because we did the war on terror 24/7, 365 for 20 years. And so when you're either in combat or you're, you know, sleeping to get ready for your next combat flight, you don't have the margin to do anything else. And so we barely had time to really train for the current fight, let alone the next one. And so I think by getting deployment to dwell right, we create opportunities to prep for the near peer because we now have half a squadron that's at home that can think about this. Now, one of the other great challenges we run into during the transition, though, is just finding that we've had a kind of a lack of resources here in the U.S. to train with. And so what that looks like is what many people don't realize is there's not very many MQ-9 stateside. And the ones that are owned by the units called our launch and recovery units that use them to practice takeoff and landing because that's what they do downrange for us. And so we can't just go outside and, you know, jump on our F-16 and go train. We don't necessarily have the aircraft here to do that. And, you know, we've run into some other problems where, you know, the FAA is still a little uneasy about us being in the national airspace system. And that kind of prevents us from getting into some of the large scale exercises we like to get into. So, you know, none of these are insurmountable by any stretch, but they're just obstacles we've had to deal with as we tried to begin to transition and train to the great power competition. Unfortunately for us, it wasn't like day one of our deploy to dwell contract. We just went out and started integrating with F-35s and large scale exercises. So, you know, we've really had to wrestle with how we pursue great power competition in light of extremely limited home station flying.
Okay, here's one for you. If you are COCOM commander for a day in the Pacific or in Europe, where would you seek to accelerate the MQ-9 mission capability engagement? Are there specific roles and missions we should consider where the MQ-9 can bring significant value?
I think first and foremost, in the Indo-PACOM theater, I think we can continue to promulgate the use of MQ-9s in the maritime environment. I mean, we've recently seen some of the strengths of the MQ-9 used in this capacity. Is it as capable as the Navy's P-3 or P-8 in maritime surveillance and anti-submission sets? No, it's not, but it wasn't designed for that. But with the addition of, you know, modular sensors and TTP development, can we make it useful in an AOR that covers, I think, like 50% of the Earth's surface? Absolutely, I think we can. I think when you look at the EUCOM theater, you look at the Russians just continuing to exploit the gray zone level of conflict, you know, above statecraft and below the full-scale war. And they do it pretty much out in the open at this point. And they just continue to try to exploit the seams. And I think it was the Minister of Defense at one point when he was questioned on Ukraine said something to the effect of, I can only say one thing. It's hard to search for a black cat in a dark room. Well, guess what the MQ-9 is really good at? It's good at finding black cats in dark rooms. And so in addition to the full motion video, the MQ-9 has a host of plug and play signals intelligence capabilities that can be used in gray zone ops to really illuminate to the world what the Russians are doing. And I think in both theaters, you know, because the asset is unmanned, it's an easier poker chip to play to test the limits of both the technical prowess of the adversaries we're looking at right now and the length at which they're willing to go to defend their, you know, expanding influence and land grabs we've seen.
Now, critics like to suggest that if you're not the latest tech in combat aircraft, you're irrelevant in these wars. We obviously need types like the B-21, the B-2, the F-35, and the F-22, but what are some of the ways the MQ-9 can adapt and evolve to remain a key player?
Yeah, and Doug spoke to this earlier too. You know, being survivable in future wars, it's not an on-off switch where you're either survivable or you're not. It really does have layers to it. And so is the MQ-9 going to be leading the formation from the front on day zero into a heavily contested IADS environment? No, not at all. But, and I hope General Deptula will forgive me when I say this, but, you know, frankly, neither is an F-15C model in 2021. And so does that mean the C model is totally useless and it needs to be sent to the boneyard? No, not at all. It just means we need to use it in a layer that allows it to likely survive and succeed. We need every aircraft we can get at this point in the Air Force. So for the MQ-9 specifically, you know, we've looked at ways of employing it as a C2 command and control node. Again, that modular plug and play capability comes into play again here. We've looked at a series of pods that can collect and disseminate information. Battle space awareness is definitely a function that's needed in all layers. We've continually looked at long-range fires. I don't need to get within a threat ring of an SA system if I have a weapon that can be launched outside of that ring. Base defense is another area we've looked at here, especially with the Air Force's adaptive basing concept, which is the notion that in the future, the Air Force is going to have to deploy, you know, small teams in short amounts of time to expeditionary operating airfields. I see the MQ-9 as potentially being a part of that kind of a team. And then lastly, we've really taken kind of a relook at an ancient concept of warfare, the idea of skirmishers, you know, lightly armed units who are designed and trained to engage, you know, on favorable terms ahead of a main battle line or formation and then immediately retreat. They, you know, they weren't designed to hold ground or engage with the enemy's primary force, but they weren't supposed to. And so, you know, we've looked at ways that we can kind of employ that guerrilla-like tactics from the air in future warfare.
Johnny, can you describe potential improvements that the MQ-9 platform could expand in both mission sets and durability for higher threat environments, which are much higher than what the MQ-9 is flying in today?
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think, you know, first and foremost, you know, we're looking at hardening our data link infrastructure. And we've made some progress at that, but we need to continue to make inroads with this. I think it was General Goldfein talked about how air superiority is not a birthright. And I would say that along those same lines, neither is, you know, unfettered access to the electromagnetic spectrum. We've had that for two decades. I don't think we're going to have it as a guarantee in the future warfare. So we're looking to kind of harden that data link infrastructure that we need to operate in that kind of an environment. Additionally, and this is one, you know, some folks might scoff at, and I'll be honest, I kind of did too initially, but we're looking at some air-to-air capabilities, you know, and that's another area where we've made some pretty significant strides, but we need to continue to see investment to see, you know, how we can continue to pursue this further. And again, am I saying that the MQ-9 is going to get sent up against a J-20 or an SU-57? Yeah, of course not. But let me tell you what I don't think is a smart fight for us, and that's putting up an F-35 or an F-22 to counter, you know, any and every version of a quadcopter or a mini UAV that threatens our, you know, forward operating bases and ships in the future. You know, if you're putting your queen in constant danger to fight off pawns, you're not playing the game very strategically. And I think one of the last things we're looking at here pretty extensively is something we're calling, you know, automated takeoff and land. And what this is essentially allowing us to get the aircraft to essentially take off and land on its own through some artificial intelligence advancements we've made. And what that does is that significantly broadens the areas in which we can operate, because what it does is it really reduces the footprint that we are required to have right now to operate. And it also simultaneously frees up some additional manpower, because all those LRE crews we talked about earlier can now become trained to execute the mission portion of the mission. And what that does is it brings us closer to that ideal deploy to dwell construct we talked about earlier, which just gives us increased focus and time into figuring out how we integrate the MQ-9 into future battle plans and whatnot.
All right, so we obviously have a wealth of knowledge with the men and women who operate the MQ-9. How can those folks help to prototype future unmanned aircraft systems and operating concepts?
Yeah, I think the answer to this one is just if we can get the funding for a lot of tools that we can just continue to just throw in the aircraft and take it up and try to figure out, you know, hey, what works and what doesn't work, and give the feedback and move from there. You know, the MQ-9 is an extremely cost-effective way to test out not only new tools, but, you know, operating concepts. And as we continue to explore what the future fight looks like, we're just going to need resource to be able to do that. And as we get, you know, more time and we continue to develop that at home, you know, flying program, it's the perfect opportunity to take stuff out and just use the platform in a way that allows us to explore the different avenues we're looking at right now. I don't think anyone right now has the exact answer for what the future fight looks like, for what exact tools are needed, for what exact concepts we need to explore. But the MQ-9 is absolutely the perfect platform to start throwing things on and testing things out and giving feedback and saying, hey, this worked, this didn't work. Let's go ahead and try this avenue, and just continuing to pivot back and forth from there.
Well, I really appreciate your thoughts on all of this. And what I would like to state publicly is how much all of us at Mitchell deeply respect what you do and what your team are accomplishing. People sometimes think that because these aircraft are uninhabited, that they somehow magically work on their own, and nothing can be further from the truth. The load on you guys is so tremendous, and it's not like you get to spool up for a deployment, go fly your missions, and then come home. You're always on station, and that is a lot for us to ask of you, especially after two decades of nonstop combat operations. But it also speaks to the criticality of what you do and the MQ-9. It is the linchpin of the enterprise.
Yeah, thanks a lot. So again, it was an honor to get to talk to you. I appreciate getting to talk about these sorts of things, and happy to come back anytime.
Now, we're going to hear from a member of the General Atomics team, the company that invented, builds, and sustains the MQ-9. And this is a really unique story, because the MQ-9 and its predecessor, the MQ-1 Predator, which was basically a smaller version of the MQ-9, they were the brainchild of the company experts on their own. This program didn't come from a military requirement. General Atomics team members understood the operating environment, and they saw there was a better way to accomplish this mission. As is usually the case with these things, they had to fight for a seat at the table for their idea to be considered, and thank goodness they did. I cannot emphasize how important their aircraft and the resulting concepts of operation have been to the U.S. ever since they were first tested over Bosnia in the 1990s. Now, we sort of take it for granted, but the technology blew people's mind back then, and it's no joke, four-star generals would have TVs on their desk watching the video feeds coming off of these aircraft. The President of the United States was talking about this technology with awe. It is a true game changer. So with that, I am pleased to introduce Jamie Walters, who serves as the chief architect for the MQ-9 with General Atomics.
I appreciate the invitation and happy to be here.
Well, let's kick this off with some stats. And I know that you know the MQ-9 scorecard. So how many hours has the aircraft flown, and what percentage of that time reflects combat hours?
So I kind of want to take it a little broader and say that just really the family of systems that General Atomics has developed, we're rapidly approaching 7 million cumulative flight hours.
Wow.
So just a wealth of experience and knowledge that we've gained through that. And MQ-9 really represents about half of those total flight hours. And right now, accumulating about 300,000 flight hours or more per year. And as a family of systems growing at about 650,000 flight hours per year, and as new customers come on board, that's just going to continue that growth. Now, the other thing I want to mention too is about 90% of those hours are in combat. So it's not just, flying around the flagpole hours or training hours. About 90% of those MQ-9 hours are actually collected in combat, but they're reliable flight hours. And I don't know if you saw the report last year, but it was reported that MQ-9 was the highest, or had the highest mission availability rate of over 90% in U.S. Air Force inventory, making it the highest reliable aircraft in their inventory. So it's there when they need it.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. And one of the other things that's pretty incredible is how the MQ-9 has evolved from the early production aircraft of the early 2000s to what the Air Force is flying today.
Yeah, it's continuing to evolve. And as I mentioned earlier, in April will be my 17th year here, and really have been able to see the MQ-9 evolve from its early days rolling off the production line and to what the aircraft is today and being employed operationally. We've grown the electrical power system. You know, it's a 5-time improvement over the earlier platform. So now we have 45 kVA power on board. We've been able to extend the range of the platform through external fuel tanks and adding up to 10 hours of endurance on the platform. But it's not just the platform itself, it's where sensors are going as well. And the sensor technologies is really what's making a unmanned aircraft valuable. You know, you take an unmanned aircraft, it's great at converting fuel to noise without any sensors, right? Sure. But with this advancement in sensor technology and what they're doing, it's going to really open up new mission space for MQ-9s. Artificial intelligence is rapidly maturing as well, and we're going to be able to integrate artificial intelligence at the tactical edge and really start performing more autonomous collaborative operations, automated target development at the edge, and being able to push that to edge users to inform the battle space.
I was just going to ask you about, you know, what you're describing here. Is that part of what we will see with the MQ-9B? As I'm understanding it, it's the most advanced version, but primarily going to be operated by our allies. So what are the unique characteristics there?
So I think we'll see some of that on the MQ-9B. Initially, that is going to be deployed with our allies, but Air Force is really leading that charge with the artificial intelligence and where that is going. With MQ-9B, we really see that as a game-changing capability, and there's a lot of reasons why. What MQ-9B is we've taken the MQ-9 Alpha and we've really redesigned the MQ-9 Alpha for certifiability. And why that's important is it's going to allow us to integrate into national airspace systems or fly in international airspace, because we've equipped it with collision avoidance systems, with TCAS and ADS-B, as well as a purpose-built collision avoidance radar to avoid other air traffic. So now we can integrate in national airspace systems like other manned platforms. Also, we've integrated all-weather capability on the platform. So at times, MQ-9 Alpha may not be able to launch because of, say, icing conditions. With the MQ-9 Bravo series, now we're going to be able to launch in those conditions, go out and perform that mission, and increase our mission availability rate. The other big thing that we've done on the MQ-9 Bravo during that redesign process, we had the external fuel tanks to extend the range and endurance of the platform. Well, on the MQ-9 Bravo, we've taken the wingspan, we've grown it from 66 feet to 79 feet. But why that's important is now we're able to suck that fuel that we had in the tanks up into the wings, extend the endurance. And a couple of years ago, we actually had an endurance test flight on our prototype system and we flew for 48.2 hours.
Wow.
Now granted, it's a little bit of a stunt flight, but because it was a highly optimized flight profile, but the aircraft was in flight for 2 days. And now we're measuring endurance instead of days.
Right.
So the other thing I do want to draw on too, out of that 79-foot wing, is we're able to perform expeditionary operations. So today's MQ-9 Alpha has a large forward operating footprint, ground control stations, flight crews forward, to perform manual launch and recovery operations. Well, with the MQ-9 Bravo, we're going to be able to now operate expeditionary. With that 79-foot wing, it means we can get into shorter fields. With the 79-foot wing and the advancement of SATCOM launch and recovery, all operations are going to be performed over SATCOM. So now we get into a shorter field over SATCOM, and now we could, you know, follow, like I say, a C-130 or CV-22 that comes in with maintenance crews, two pallets of equipment, and ability to refuel the aircraft, operate on short fields, and fly in, land behind it, turn the aircraft, refuel it, push it back into the mission. The crew loads the aircraft, and then they go to the next runway. So talking about complicating an adversary's targeting problem, MQ-9 Bravo is really going to change the landscape of where we're going with the MQ-9 series.
Yeah, I mean, we're thinking about employing air power in a totally different way, you know, from an austere locations and changing up from a targeting standpoint from the enemy, like you mentioned. You mentioned a couple of things that I want to key in on with the MQ-9. We've talked a lot about the actual airplane itself, but I'm really interested in some of the things that you mentioned as far as things that are involving the control stations for the crews, the communication links, and other things. Can you expand on the enterprise a little bit more?
Yeah, so, you know, we really look at the MQ-9 system and really all of our systems, not just as an airplane, not just as a ground control station, but really call it from detector to display. And that display could be anywhere. So designing these systems, we want to make sure everything works together. So you have the platform, you have the SATCOM command and control data links, you have line of sight, and eventually mesh networks on the platform for better connectivity across the battle space. And the ground side, we've, you know, developed several variants of ground control stations, but where we see the future going is to more multi-mission control, more task-oriented operations where, going back to our earlier conversation, with increased AI on board, increased processing power on board, now I can go assign the aircraft a task to go search this area and report back some behavior or something it identifies. Now that's where operators can get into the loop, watch what's happening, and determine if there's actionable information there, or maybe is a false alarm, or maybe it wasn't quite what we were looking for. That's going to really free up more flight crews, because now I can have a single pilot through a multi-mission controller control up to, say, six aircraft for just routine ISR, maybe transit operations. As we start operating for more and more austere locations, maybe we're off, you know, transiting 2 to 6 hours to get on station. Well, you don't want to have a flight crew dedicated to every one of those transit. Why not just have a multi-mission controller, you know, perform the flight operation during that transit operation to get on station? When something becomes more dynamic, now you hand it off to a ground control station to actually perform that dynamic part of the mission, whether it be search and rescue operations to a precision strike mission. That ground control station there is to really help with that dynamic operation, where the routine and kind of the boring, you could have one pilot flying up to six aircraft.
Well, speaking of the ground control station, I wanted to ask you a couple of questions on that, because, you know, and I always feel bad for my engineer friends that, you know, always get the blame of, you know, well, the engineer made it this way. But, you know, with the need for the MQ-9 to be fielded as fast as possible, of course, you know, you just had to take what you had. And, you know, some of my buddies that fly it, you know, said, hey, you know, from an engineering standpoint, integrating the pilot or the crew into the ground control station, you know, was tough. It was just what the engineers designed and what was fielded, and it was, you know, quote unquote, good enough. But of course, everybody adapted and they made it a very lethal and effective machine. But what is GA working on to fix some of the human interface into the ground control station?
So over the last, I would say, decade, we've really concentrated on that human machine interface, and through working groups with Air Force to working with universities to design a cockpit instead of what we originally had in our ground control stations was really designed by engineers for engineers and pilots forced to fly from it. And this next generation cockpit began as a program called the Block 50 Ground Control Station with Air Force. And we've developed a lot of advanced user interfaces with that, HOTAS controls. So your hands on throttle controls for sensor and operations that they may be routinely controlling on the aircraft are now on your throttle and flight stick. So we've taken that, and with the introduction of the MQ-9 Bravo as well, since MQ-9 Bravo is a certifiable aircraft, well, part of that aircraft is also a cockpit. So we've taken that Block 50 design and we added a certifiable component to that for flight critical operations. So we've integrated a flight management system that you would actually find in a business jet. And we've integrated that to support that flight critical functionality that's required for certification in the ground control station. We're calling that the certified GCS. And that is paired up with our MQ-9 Bravo. The other thing that I talked to briefly was the multi-mission controller and where we're going with the multi-mission controller for having a single operator control up to 6 aircraft for that routine ISR, as well as just the transit operations. So if they're located at a distance, they transit for 6 hours, you could have a single operator controlling up to 6 aircraft and really driving the manpower requirements down for the system. And I'd say the final thing we're really looking at is these aircraft collect an enormous amount of information. But that information is just information until somebody looks at it. Well, with all that information, you have high manning requirements to look at all that information. So we're investing in really auto payload exploitation and dissemination capabilities in the processing of that information into something that's actionable. Are we just staring at a scene in the desert or open ocean, or is there something of interest in that maritime vessel because there's two that are side by side and there's some transfer going on? Or why is this guy walking across the desert and digging a hole? So there's all kinds of AI that can be applied to drive the manning requirements down on the back end, converting of that information into something that's actually actionable and intelligent.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like incredible leaps are being made. One of the things that I want to transition into is talking about like a highly contested environment, because it's obvious that things are going to be a lot more demanding. Things like the communication links being under attack, bases being under attack. Can you talk to us about how GA is anticipating these sorts of challenges and work to address them?
Yeah, so operations in that highly contested and what benefit the MQ-9 can actually provide. And there's significant benefit that if we're on the fringe of that highly contested environment and providing a communications node that we can pass information forward to those fifth and future 6th-gen platforms to ensure there's connectivity. We can do long range targeting an electronic order of battle from the platform. So these forward deployed penetrating assets are better informed of the environment and they can remain in that LO configuration or low observable configuration, as opposed to having to emit or having to expose some vulnerability of those platforms. We can be on that tactical edge informing that battle space. Secondly, we have developed a self-protection capability, and it's in a podded capability that is effective against RF and IR threats. And is it going to defeat the highest threat? Well, that's even challenging for some of our most advanced platforms. But sure, for a majority of what's out there, we can be much more survivable. And we're also looking at the communications link and how do we actually improve our communications links for resiliency. And it's really a system level problem. It's not just a data link problem. And by integrating multiple data links at the system level, now we can actually have much more resilient communications. And we're demonstrating in this in ABMS demonstrations as well as other exercises.
Yeah. Now, one of the things, and you mentioned it in that last answer, but I want to key in on at Mitchell, we've done a lot of focus on things like unmanned teaming and how remotely piloted or autonomous type vehicles may assist fifth or sixth or seventh gen airplanes. Who knows what we'll do in the future. Where do you think the MQ-9 stacks in this mix, and how can you help pioneer some of the foundational technologies that will help buy down some risk?
So, MQ-9 is just an absolute perfect test bed, right? So the MQ-9 was designed to be this multi-role platform. And with integration of open architecture on the platform, we're going to be able to rapidly integrate new capabilities and experiment in exercises or demonstrations, new technologies that really could be quickly lifted and dropped into next generation assets. Secondly, with Link 16 coming on board the platform, we're going to have much greater connectivity across the force and inform the battle space. Because what is MQ-9? It's really this persistent, long endurance information collection platform out there that when you look at it, it's like a dynamically tasked low Earth orbit satellite that's there when you need it and you can put it where you want it, collecting this information through and then be able to disseminate it out to the edge over, say, Link 16 or mesh networks or other capabilities. The other thing to note too is MQ-9 today is already performing manned unmanned teaming operations. While it's limited in capability just due to the hardware on board, it is doing that today, and it's only going to improve with introduction of Link 16 on the platform.
Gotcha. So what technical upgrades do you think are going to be most important to facilitate operating in this new realm of man-on-man teaming and then, you know, future threat environments in a highly contested environment?
So I would look at the platform and say probably the biggest technical upgrade we can make to it is making it more adaptable and quickly integrate new capabilities on the platform. And that's really going to happen through Open Mission Systems, which is an open architecture standard that will allow us to quickly and rapidly adapt capabilities to the platform and not have to go through these big, long test cycles and integration cycles that can last years before an operator sees new capability out there. With Open Mission Systems, now we can rapidly integrate new capabilities on the platform. And I really see that as a key enabler to taking us to the new missions, expanding missions, and really experimentation for the future.
Awesome. Well, my last question for you is, many folks may not know that the Reaper inventory is already bought and paid for. But as the threat is increasing in places where we continually use the aircraft, places like the Middle East, Africa, and elsewhere, what can be done with the Reaper to improve it to be more durable in the mission? And then obviously we talked about future missions, but thinking about building up its resiliency, and what does the price tag look on any of these increases?
I really look at Reaper. It's going to be around for a long, long time. And you look at like a startup cost of a new program, I'd say for the startup cost for a brand new program, next generation platform, we're going to be able to make those modernization and capability improvements to the Reaper to sustain it through the years to come. And you look at some of the older platforms, we're still flying B-52s and A-10s out there. And these platforms have really proved resiliency. So I wouldn't necessarily ever call those platforms legacy platforms, because what is a legacy platform? It's really, you know, legacy by time is maybe not the right definition, but really it's what value is it contributing? And I see MQ-9 contributing value through these modernization efforts, and we're not talking big price tags. We're talking, in the, tens to maybe $100 million, you could go upgrade these platforms, the entire fleet, which is large, and significantly improve the resiliency, the capabilities of the platform to take it into that next fight. And what MQ-9 really provides is that affordable system that is going to carry us through this competition phase. And I really see it carrying us into the future and being able to inform the future of where we need to go by investing in this platform today.
Well, Jamie, I can't say thanks enough for you being here today with us. Really appreciate the time and the insight.
Well, I really appreciate the opportunity, and MQ-9 is a definite passion, been here a long time. So again, thanks for having me.
Really hard to believe we've been flying these remotely piloted aircraft for over two decades. Now, I remember when they first came out in the operational world and they were game changers. And now, like I said, we've taken them for granted, but it doesn't mean we can take our foot off the gas pedal when it comes to innovating for their future use. It's always worth remembering that the RPA advocates had to fight for a seat at the table. And with budgets getting tight, we need to ensure this doesn't happen again. This is an operational technology. It's foundational to modern warfare. With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to our guests for joining in today's discussion. I'd also like to extend a big thank you to you, our listeners, for your continued support and for tuning in to today's show. If you like what you've heard today, don't forget to hammer down on that like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment for us to let us know what you think about our show or areas you would like to hear more about. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn. And you can always find us at MitchellAerospacePower.org. Until next time, this is John Slickbaum. Stay safe and check six.